Well, so welcome back. Episode 51. We've nearly hit a year. Fuck. I can't believe you guys still listen to us. That blows my mind.
Oh, I stopped listening like 15 episodes ago. I'm like, I'm done with this shit.
You stopped listening.
Yeah, I'm done. I'm good.
We are going to continue along with the question and answers that we got from our Facebook post a few weeks back. So, again, thanks for everyone for chipping into that. It's been really cool to get some involvement from you guys. Go on.
Yeah, there's a fair few for us to get through. So it might be a bit longer episode, but like hang in there. There's definitely some good questions in there.
Sweet. For sure. We're going to talk about, trail running, poles, tempo runs, sub-3 marathons, how to carry your keys, plenty of things. but I have a quick little something I just want to talk about super quick before we get into it. I'm going to, and this is more for the people who don't live locally in Sydney or around the clinic, is I'm going to start doing a remote physio consult or a remote runner's consult, not necessarily just physio, to actually go through some strength work and go through a bit of technique and load management and programming. So I think that's something that we're going to offer in the not too distant future. And I've actually had a few people come in, from interstate, from different parts of New South Wales and Australia to have a run on our treadmill and get their technique assessed. And I'm thinking of doing some kind of follow-up ongoing consults. So that's something that we'll be doing in the next, few weeks, I suppose. And I think Mike can do the same.
Yeah, I'm planning to set up the same for anybody that needs help with a running program or needs a program designed, because I do a lot of online work for people. And most of the people I meet in person and then set up the program online, but we can also do that over Skype or over Zoom or via the interwebs. We can set these things up and make that work, because we don't want to just keep this knowledge in Australia but just for everyone out there.
Yeah, should be able to share it with a lot of people. So if anyone is interested in doing anything remotely one-on-one, then please send us a message, because we're really keen to help as many people as we can, and that doesn't have to be limited by geography. So reach out and we'll see if we can start to set something up over the next few weeks. We'll just work out the back end and we'll try and get something together, and we'll keep you guys all posted with what we end up doing there. Because I think there's a lot of value that you guys can get from being a little bit more specific rather than just listening to this podcast. So for now, reach out if there's something you're interested in, and we'll keep you posted as we organize that.
Yeah, we're pretty excited about it, to just take it to the next level and help you guys out there.
Yeah, it's taken us 51 fucking weeks. So let's do it. Yeah.
No, it's taken us 51 weeks to talk about this. It's going to take another 51 weeks to set it up.
Yeah, that's probably true, to be honest. Oh, even just talking about it makes me tired. all right, well, we'll get into some of the questions. And we're going to start off with a couple talking about pace and tempo and effort and how you should measure that, how fast it should be. So shout outs to Jack Wilson and Chris Horton, who've flicked us through these questions on Facebook. So Jack asks, how fast should a tempo be and how do you measure it?
Do you measure it, Paddy, when you run?
Yeah, I do. I measure my tempo, but I measure more often than not, I look at it as I look at speed and pace, not heart rate, not power. And my speed and pace is more a result of the session. So I use that to see how I've gone. I don't base my session on, I want to be hitting 3:50 pace or whatever. I don't set that as a target. I do all my tempo work based off effort, and I use, whatever outcome measure it might be. Usually for me, it's pace. I use that as a result to see how I went. But when I do tempo runs, it's based off effort, and we use RPE, which stands for rate of perceived exertion. So again, this is different for everyone. It's really subjective. So I like to do my tempos at a rate where I can't really talk. If I can talk and if I can chat, I'm probably going too slow. And I want to be really at that point where I know that I'm not going to be able to hold this very long and I can't really chat. And then once I've done that and I'm hitting that sort of effort level, then I'll look at my pace. depending on the day, that might be a 3-minute 50 pace. It might be a 3-minute 10 pace, depending on the day. So that just allows a bit of fluidity in my training to do it based off feel and exertion rather than sort of tempo. How do you do yours, Mike?
Look, I think what you just said is super important. It is really day dependent, because sometimes you have a brilliant day and you're running amazingly, and other days you might not have had the best sleep, and it's just a bit of a harder day. So I think in going off that RPE and going cool based on how I feel, looking at your watch and going, oh, this is the pace I'm running at today, I think that's super important. The other thing you mentioned is heart rate. You don't really do that. I'm definitely big on not using it, because it's not properly measured for us, because nobody really knows our max heart rate exactly. Nobody really knows their proper resting heart rate. And there's so much, it's so variable. It's really hard to properly use that. And I do basically the same what you do. I just look at, I know sort of how I normally run. So I go, if I run a tempo, I should be able to give or take run this. Yes. And I set a range. I never said I have to run at 3:15. If I set a range, it's like I aim to run this between 4 and 4:15, give or take. And I like a bit of that fluidity there as well.
Yeah, and that if you're feeling good, then you'll hit it. You might even go a little bit quicker. If you're not feeling good, then you won't hit that. And I think using other metrics as an outcome measure, like your heart rate, your power, your whatever other people use, is that should be used to guide your sessions, but not used to dictate your sessions.
Yeah, so absolutely.
You might be running and your heart rate might be through the roof, but you're just at it, cruising along. And then, why can't you push that a little bit harder? Or you might be pushing really hard and your heart rate's not that high. I think a heart rate can be used to guide your workout and it can influence it, but I don't think you should dictate it.
Unless you have a heart condition, then please don't listen to us.
Yeah. But if you have a heart condition and you're a runner, that means you have a heart condition and you're dumb. So I don't know.
So good luck.
So end result, listen to someone else. Chris Horton asks, when you're building pace, how do you determine how much to build it by? I'm like, cool. How long is that piece of string you're holding? Like, what's the goal? What do you want to do? What do you want to do with that piece of string? So again, if we use if I do my pace, my tempo, if it's based on RPE, then as I get fitter, my speed will be faster for the same RPE, if that makes sense. So I'm at the same, what's that?
I think that's the nail on the head right there.
Yeah. So I think Chris is more asking, do I increase, do I go from, 4:50 pace to 4:45 to 4:40 to 4:35? I'm like, no, I don't think you can be that specific. There's so much variability day to day. Or can you do that by heart rate? I think if you keep your rate of perceived exertion for a tempo run at a 6 to 7 out of 10 and just keep it there for all of your tempo runs, as you get fitter, you will get faster. That's the benefit. So that's my answer, Chris.
No, Mike? I totally agree with that. Because as you get fitter, your 7 will be a faster run.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Or if you keep the same pace as you get fitter, that rate of perceived exertion will go from a 7 down to a 6 down to a 5, but you'll still be holding that same pace. So, yeah, it kind of goes both ways.
Easy. All right, well, that's pretty straightforward there for Jack's question is a bit more personal, where Chris... fairly easy. Don't overthink it. So let's move on to Paul Barr. Paul does 3 runs and no strength training. I think he's aiming for a 17:35K at the moment. He did a 17:31 recently. So the question is, should he drop 1 run and add 1 strength, or should he keep his 3 runs and he can only do 3 and do some strength training at home with bits and pieces?
So I think thanks for coming straight up and saying, hey, I'm Paul, I'm a pretty quick runner and I don't do strength. So kudos for throwing that out there, Paul. That's really cool. So 3 runs a week. Do I keep 3, no strength, or do I drop down to 2 and do 1 strength session? Again, dude, what are your goals? What's the context of it? So if you are someone who's running a 17 and a half minute to an 18 minute 5K and you're happy with that and that's cool, then don't do strength. But if we know that you want to continue running into the future, then we know that strength training decreases your risk of injury by about 50%. So like, why wouldn't you do it? A lot of runners, it does bring up an interesting point. A lot of runners are hesitant to do strength training because A, it takes time away from their running, but B, it'll leave them sore for their runs. So my kind of response is I think every single runner should always do strength training no matter what, all the time, always. It's just how much you do it and how you fit it into your program that is a bit more subtle and it's more nuanced. So I think, yes, always do running. So Paul's question was, should I drop from 3 down to 2 runs per week and do strength? Absolutely, I think so. It'll make you a more resilient runner. It'll make you more robust, less injury prone. It's actually been shown to increase performance as well. But on the other hand, a strength session doesn't have to be 1 hour in the gym. A strength session can be do 15 minutes worth of body weight stuff after your run. You can structure it that way. So should he do strength? Yes. Does it have to be the sacrifice of a whole run? No. So you can be smart about it. There are heaps of different ways you can do that, Paul.
Yeah. So on that note, you can do it also, like if you run in the morning, you can do strength at night. And you can do stuff at home, and like something is better than nothing. Like, especially if let's say you want to run 3 days a week because of whatever, because mental health, and it's just you need to do that because it makes you feel good, regardless of time or anything else. Like keep your 3 runs, do some additional stuff at home every other day. Mm-hmm. The days that you're not running, do some body weight stuff, do some plyometrics, and then go from there. Like anything is, any sort of strength training is better than no strength training.
Yeah, definitely. So I think obviously the best option is, can you get to the gym once or twice a week and lift some heavy stuff? That's the best option. If you can't, then if it's a time management option, everyone can spend 5 to 10 minutes at the end of a run doing some form of strength work. On Monday, do your run and then do some calf strength afterwards. On Thursday, do your run and do some glute strength afterwards. Everyone can do that. There's literally no excuses for not doing that. That's not a time management thing. That's shortening your run by 5 to 10 minutes and doing some strength at the end.
Yeah, and you'll survive with a 10-minute shorter run.
Yeah. Yeah, you will thrive with a 10-minute shorter run.
Yeah.
It's hard. And Paul, there's a billion different ways to do that. It's different for everyone, given your background, your speed, and injuries you've got, availability to equipment. Like, there's so many factors. There's so many different ways to do it. So, it's tricky. But there you go. That's our thoughts. Rachel Summers asks for top 3 exercises for trail runners. Oh, fuck. I've got like a top 30. I don't know about 3. Mike?
3. trail running, uphill running, downhill running.
Yeah.
Done. That's 3 exercises for trail runners, right?
Run uphill and run downhill.
Three is so limited. Where do you start? Like, that's cutting so many good exercises that we would miss if we say, oh, these are the best 3.
Like, we can give the way I look at it,
body muscle.
Go on. Sorry, say that again.
Like, we can have a top 3 for each muscle group, basically.
Exactly. Well, what I was going to say is there are like 3 things that I want to hit for every single runner. Do something in your calf, do something for your glute, and do something overall to generate power. So if I had to give a top 3 for trail, well, this is more for overall runners, but trail runners in particular, I would do a bent knee calf raise. So a soleus calf raise would be one. I would do a single leg squat with a resistance band around your kneecaps. I would do that. And if you do that well, that will hit your glutes. If you do it poorly, it'll kind of hit nothing. So I've got the soleus calf, the bent knee calf raise, the single leg squat with a band, and I would probably do some, and I've been experimenting with this recently as well, is some shallow range, heavy, rapid squats. So I've been throwing really heavy weight on my back, and I've just been doing like half depth squats, controlling it down and powering back up out of the squat there. And so I'm trying to make that a knee dominant exercise to strengthen my quads. So we know that trail running flogs your quads. So I've been doing, inner range squats, really heavy with a bit of a rapid movement at the end of it. So there you go. That's my top three ones specific for trail, I suppose, which is, pretty similar to normal running, but that squat one with your kind of trying to make it a knee dominant squat was really beneficial.
Yeah, I like the knee dominant squat one. Like if I can add an optional fourth, it would be some sort of balanced proprioception exercise, especially if you have a history of rolled ankles and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So a bit of jumping on and off uneven surfaces, like hopping on and off a towel, stuff like that, where you can do bits and pieces that strengthen like more intrinsic ankle stuff. Because I think that's super important for trail runners.
Yeah, definitely. And even like doing that drill to a really high cadence can actually help as well.
So that's our top 3.5.
3.5. Yeah. I'm going to stop there because otherwise we'll make it a top 6.
Yeah, like let's move on. All right, moving on to... Sorry, what was that, Paddy? We're talking remotely if people have not noticed. And it's sort of we're cutting in and out of each other because it's like we're not actually having a face-to-face conversation. So
Mike is jet lagged as fuck because he just got back from Europe.
I was up this morning at 4 and I've been up since 4 for the last like 2 nights. So for me, it's bedtime now. moving on. Matthew Somerville. I've coached Matty, I've run with Matty. Matty has been in clinic multiple times and Matt asks about technique when you're using your poles, and this also leads into Lonica's question about like our thoughts on poles. Paddy, have you bought poles yet?
Yeah, I've been using poles heaps recently in the lead up to UTMB, and I have discovered how to cheat in trail running. I've worked it out. It's like taking drugs. On the uphills, you use poles, and on the downhills, you wear hockers. And that is how you cheat. Dead set. My God, it feels like you're not doing anything. So I might just be that I'm getting fitter.
Cheat sticks and thick boys is the solution.
Yeah, cheat sticks and thick boys. So Matt asks, is there a technique to do with poles? Again, there are kind of, I found there are 3 different ways to hold my poles, like in terms of where you put your hands with the wrist straps and how you hold it. There are a few different ways to hold it. So experiment with like thumb on top or whether you actually bear the weight through the wrist straps. There's a couple different ways to hold it. And when you push down with the pole and you push behind your body, you can do it through shoulder extension or elbow extension. So really, it's pretty hard to imagine when you're just sitting here listening to it, but if you're out there actually pushing with poles, you can push back with your shoulder whilst keeping your elbow flexed, or you can actually push back with your elbow as well. So when you actually physically get out there and try, there are 2 slightly different ways to physically push back with the poles. And there's no right or wrong, but it's helpful to do a few kilometers using mainly like shoulder extension and then do the next few kilometers with some elbow extension and actually mix that up. I find that's what works with me as well. The other thing is how to actually like plant them in front of you. And again, there's no right or wrong way, but certainly the way that I like to do it is for every 6 or 8 or 10 steps, I use the left and the right pole once. So I plug them in the ground ahead of me while I'm taking short, quick, rapid steps. So I'm taking little steps, high cadence, and I'm pushing back with the poles in big, long strides. So think about the poles having a really low cadence. So, every like 5 or so steps that I take, I push off with the pole once. And I kind of go, I plant my right pole, then I plant my left pole, and I push back with both of them, lift the right up, lift the left up, and I push down with the right, push down with the left, pull back with both, and then I lift up with the right, lift up with the left, if that map sort of makes sense. So you're going right, left, right, left with a bit of a gap in between, and while your feet in between going tick, 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 along with a really high cadence. So that's kind of what works for me. There's heaps on YouTube about that. Killian Jornet, my hero, has got a pretty good YouTube video about that on YouTube. But again, that's just what seems to work quite efficiently for me, having practiced them heaps the last few weeks.
Yeah, cool.
And so, yeah, thoughts on poles is, yeah, it's honestly, it's like cheating for the uphills. Once you use them, you're like, how have I never done these before? It's brilliant.
just do you use them on the downhill?
No, I don't, not at all. I find they just get in the way.
Okay.
And also, if you trip and you're holding onto a pole, you're fucked.
good point.
But I honestly don't use them for up for the downs at all, but ups, certainly.
Monica also asks, is it worth carrying poles all the way for potentially only a short amount of usage during a race?
Yeah, I think so.
Let's say, like, UTA 50 is, like, you're probably carrying the poles mainly to get out of Kadamba Valley.
Yeah.
Worth it?
Absolutely.
Okay.
And so, I think if you carry the poles well, like, I carry the poles on a waist belt, it sits around my waist. So as I'm running, the poles are literally sitting across my ass and I actually forget that they're there. Like, if I've put them on correctly, I'm literally not aware of them while I'm running. I'm completely used to them and they don't weigh me down because my poles are super lightweight and they fold up really small. So when I'm running with them, I'm not even aware that they're there. So is it worth carrying them? And in my answer, yes. It's like, it doesn't detract anything from my run. As soon as there's a hill, you just whip them out. However, I wouldn't actually physically carry them in my hand 50K. That would be terrible. So if you've got a nice way to carry your poles, some people use a quiver on their pack. Some people use a waist belt. It's whatever works for you. But mine are super comfy. You just got to play around with what is comfortable for you, how to hold them.
Yeah, cool. Like, I've never used poles because I'm just hard and I'm not a little bitch like Patty. So
you just haven't seen the light, motherfucker.
Yeah, well, I don't wear Hokas either, so you know.
Yeah. Talk to me when you run a proper race, Mike.
Okay, I'll talk to you after UTMB.
Yes.
Which I'm not running, because fuck that.
No, you're not. Exactly. Hence, you're not brave to try poles on a proper race.
No need.
And Lonica asked how to become a faster trail runner. Or buy hockers and use poles.
wear poles and use hockers.
Wear poles and use hockers.
And do strength training.
Yeah, it's strength work, but it's like, it actually sounds stupid, but actually training on trails makes a huge difference. Like, and I know she lives in Sydney, and when you live in Sydney and do her training here and then try and do a race out in the Blue Mountains, yeah, that's hard and it wipes you. But if you actually get out there and train on the hills and get your body used to just hiking up the hills, that is super crucial to just becoming a better trail runner. There's that. And also practicing quick, light, nimble feet with really high cadence on the technical stuff as well. So, like, do your running, do your strength, get your poles, but also just practice on the trail. So practice the hiking hills and practice the really nimble, quick stuff under feet. Which is hard in, you know, if you live in Sydney or if you live in a urban environment, it's quite tricky, but you just got to actually train for what you're going to compete in.
Yeah. Then Lonica has one more question, and is, how do you manage a speed session with a non-irritable Achilles?
If your Achilles is bothering you, probably don't do a speed session, because that's the best way to piss off an Achilles. So if you're doing a speed session and your Achilles is bothering you, don't do the speed session. It's just not worth it. Tendons, because that's, if you're getting signs and symptoms in your Achilles during a speed session, that's your Achilles saying, hey, this is probably a little bit too much load for me. And it just comes back to load management. So I always try and make people really genuinely fix their Achilles before they add in speed, because that's quite aggravating on an Achilles tendon. Yeah. So I think if you're doing all your proper rehab and your Achilles is improving and it's getting well and you're getting no soreness after runs, then you can start to layer in some quicker work, whether it's a tempo session or an interval session, provided your Achilles doesn't have a negative reaction to it. If it's something that you find that you're having to manage through a speed session, I probably wouldn't do the speed session. I'd fix the Achilles.
My experience, having had an irritable Achilles for a long time, don't do it. It doesn't work.
Yeah,
because it will get irritated, and then your next long run you'll just feel it, and you'll feel it a few days after, it's just not worth doing yet. You need to sort it out before you can go there. Like, you're fine with long runs, just don't do the speed work.
Yeah. And I think this is something that I'm starting to realize more and more, is a lot of runners panic when they can't do speed sessions. They're like, oh, I'm not going to be fast. I'm not going to get fit. I'm not going to, like, your Achilles tendon will handle volume work much better than it will handle speed sessions. If you just do your running at 5 to 6 minute kilometers per hour, not a speed session. Minutes per kilometer.
So if you go for a walk, it's fine.
So if you just walk, it won't hurt. Your Achilles tendon can manage volume work so much better than it can manage speed sessions. And you know what? If you do heaps of volume work, you'll get really, 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 really fit. You don't need to do as much speed sessions as what a lot of people think. It's like, speed sessions is like the sexy way to train. That's what a lot of people want to do, and it's kind of fun and you get to challenge yourself. But it's fucking hard on your body, and you can get heaps fit without doing that stuff. I do one speed session a week, maybe. And so I've actually been training for an ultra marathon, doing proper volume work, a lot of long, slow stuff, with maybe one speed session a week, probably one a fortnight. And I nearly broke my half marathon PB on the weekend. Like, and I haven't been doing speed work. I've been doing volume. So, like, I don't think you need to do as much speed work as most people think to actually get fit. If you're a track runner, like an 800-meter runner, 1500-meter runner, yeah, you should probably do speed work.
But if you're generally
training for longer stuff, then just save the tendon, rehab the shit out of it.
Okay, that's a segue is nice into the next question, sort of.
What's that? Is that Cammy boy?
Cameron Lyles. Minimum weekly volume to run a sub 3 hour marathon, and one key workout on track.
So minimum weekly volume required if you want to run a sub 3 hour marathon. That's a hard question to answer. I'm sure you get some pretty elite runners who can do a sub 3 hour marathon on 20 kilometer weeks. Some people would have to do 150 kilometer weeks and still would never get there. So, like, that's probably the smallest factor you could think of in terms of trying to run a sub 3 hour marathon.
It's impossible. Like, you can't, like, there's no minimum. There's just you personally. What can you do? How much can you do? How much do you want to do? How much can you really handle? And what sort of a runner are you?
Yeah. So it's tricky, man. Again, I'd just be building your volume over a long period of time. But Cameron kind of had like a part B in his question, which I quite like. And Cameron said, what's one key workout you can use as a guide to see if you're on track to getting a sub 3 hour marathon? And I love this question. I think it's great. One thing I do is I will do a long run. Like, it might be a in the range of like 35 kilometers. So if you're training for, obviously, the marathon's 42K, do a long run that's about 35 kilometers, but make the last 10 to 15 kilometers race pace. So if you're shooting for a sub 3 marathon, we're talking like 4:15 pace. So if you can do a long run and have the last 10 or so kilometers at 4:10 pace, say, and if you get through that and that doesn't wipe you out, then cool, that's a bit of a sign that, yeah, you might have a crack at doing the sub 3. That's something I like to do, and I'd always do that like kind of 3 to 4 weeks out from a marathon. That's kind of how I approach it.
I think that's a great approach. I think that's a really good sort of, like, it's sort of a guide to go, oh, am I on track to get there? But then again, race day is race day.
Exactly. Once you pin that bib on, actually, it gives you superpowers.
Yeah. Unless it's really hot or really windy.
Yeah, in which case, no. Actually, I did a race on Sunday and my bib nearly blew off. I physically had to hold my bib onto my chest because it was that windy. So my bib did not give me superpowers. But I did run fast, so maybe it did. I don't know.
Was it tailwind?
It was a side wind. Like, it was running over a bridge, and I felt like it was going to the road. Like, I felt like my bib was going to get ripped off my shirt. So it was weird. Anyway, yeah, it was a good fun race, though.
Yeah, cool. Which one was it?
It was the Sri Chinmoy half marathon.
Oh, yeah. At Dawes Point?
Yeah. It's good. Good. I actually decided I was going to do that 12 hours before the race started. That's when I heard about it. I was actually at the pub for a mate's birthday, and one of my runner friends, his name's Mike, actually, not you, different Mike. And he was like, well, Paddy, you're going to do that half marathon tomorrow morning? I'm like, what a half marathon? And he kind of explained the Sri Chinmoy one. And I said, oh, I've always wanted to do one. Okay, I'll go and do it. It was awesome. And I actually put that up on our Instagram stories last week. It was a good day. It's good fun. I digress. Thanks, Ken. Yeah.
Sweet. Moving on. Go for it, Paddy.
Robbie. So Rob Ferguson. So Rob gets stitches when he runs after he eats slash drinks. And he's wondering if there are any tips, or is it something that, is it like a skill you just learn to be able to eat more? Is it a matter of hardening up a little bit? So yeah, I mean, like, I guess we'll start off with like, what's a stitch, right? Like a stitch is that uncomfortable feeling you get like in your side, kind of on the side of your abdomen, right? When it kind of makes it harder to breathe. Did you want to go in further on what it like a stitch is?
Like there's about two theories on stitches. One of the theories is that like blood moves away into our limbs, away from our diaphragm. Like that's the muscle that we use for breathing. And because of the lack of blood supply to the diaphragm cramps.
Yeah.
The other idea is that the stitches are caused by fluid, which the body finds hard to digest. So that the gut itself, tugs on the ligaments connecting it to the diaphragm, which will then affect the diaphragm again.
Yeah. Yeah, and the diaphragm is a muscle, and that can sort of cramp like anything else. So I think when you get a stitch, it's usually when you're pushing your body, right? Like, I think it's when you're either like right at the start of a run and you've like just started, and your body's like, whoa, what are we doing? And it kind of, your body's catching up, and then it will go away in a kilometer. So it's that kind of stitch. Or there's the kind of stitch where when you're pushing yourself, when you're redlining, that's when it kind of pops up and it kind of can ruin a run, like absolutely destroy a run. So I think if it's the sort of stitch that you get when you're pushing yourself, it's just a sign that you're pushing yourself. And yeah, there tends to be a correlation between having heaps of water or like a big meal beforehand. I personally, and this is just purely my personal experience, the fitter I get, the less stitches I get, for sure. So it's a sign that my body is a bit more conditioned. And in terms of Rob's question, like, is it a skill? Like, you can learn, like, can you just eat and drink shit and get better at it and get less stitches? I have nothing to back this up, but I would say, yes, it is a skill. If I look back over the last few years, I used to get stitches all the time. If I had eaten a certain thing within 5 hours of a run, I couldn't run because I knew it would give me a stitch. But now these days I literally run anything and run at any time. And I think I've just developed a bit of an iron stomach. That's just what I think of my purely personal experience, N=1. So there's no science behind that, but I don't know. I think it's something I've gotten better at. I think I've toughened up over the years.
Basically, Rob, what Paddy is saying is get fit and harden up and you'll be fine.
100%. It'll fix your stitches. There's no doubt about that.
What I always tell my runners is to like focus on the breathing when you have a stitch.
Yes.
Almost like if you try to not hyperventilate, but try to take a few deep, slow breaths where you just like focus on using your diaphragm. And like in my head, it almost sort of resets your diaphragm and it sort of calms it down and it helps with the stitching.
Yes. And breathe in a rhythm. So breathe with your footsteps.
Yeah.
So I used to breathe in for two steps and then out for two steps. Like I'd go in with my right and with my left, out with my right, out with my left. And that would be my breathing rhythm. That was me a few years ago when I kind of went through a bit of a running technique change and like actually increased my cadence a few years back. Because I increased my cadence, breathing with every two steps was too rapid for me. So I actually turned to breathing every three steps. So now I breathe in on my right, in on my left, in on my right, and then out on my left, out on my right, out on my left. So I breathe in for three, out for three steps. And when you get into a rhythm, that really helps get rid of the stitch because it must do something nice to your diaphragm.
So we're not 100% sure, but if anybody has the exact answer, let us know.
Yeah, any scientists out there? We should get Dr. Carl on. I reckon he'd know.
Yeah, he'd definitely know.
Yeah. Last one. We talk a quick shout out to Tina Morris. Tina Morris is from the UK. G'day, mate. She's got a few questions, just like some. Well, I guess it's really interesting, right? These are questions which I think are the most basic things you can ever ask. But obviously Tina's like quite new to it. She said she's just been running for 6 months and trying to get into it. She has a few questions about gear, and I think she's a bit overwhelmed about, you know, what to carry, when to use what, how to do this when it's raining and everything. So it's kind of cool. It's something that I think is just quite like straightforward and basic, but because I've been in the game for like years now. So Tina's like, how do I carry my phone and my keys? Mike, go.
In a pocket. That's not. I don't carry a phone because I have a watch. Some of my running tights have a little pocket for my phone, which is really handy. And I'll try to only bring one key and not like a bunch of keys, because it rattles and it bloody annoys me.
Yeah.
And every running tight has a small pocket for a key.
Yeah. Yeah. I was going to say every single one of my pair of shorts has some little pocket somewhere that I just put my house key in.
Yeah.
Or I, you know, sometimes I just shove my house key in my pot plant at the front of my house. So you can do that. And with my phone, I reckon 1/3 of my running shorts have a little pocket for my phone. Otherwise I wear, and what I actually did this morning was I have a little waist belt, just a tiny, tiny little waist belt that is like elasticated with a zip, and I stick my phone in that.
Mm.
So between the little pocket of my shorts and my phone, like I'm pretty set there. Tina also asks about a decent running watch that doesn't look like a dinner plate on your wrist. So it's a good question, right? Because a lot of running watches are quite big and chunky, and a lot of that is to actually house a big battery to allow for longer GPS life. So a lot of running watches are chunky, and so the topper high-end ones do tend to be bigger because they have a bigger battery in them. I think if she's looking for actually like a smaller one, I'd say all the major brands have their top line watches, which are bigger, and then they always have like a smaller smaller option that's usually like about $100 cheaper. So like what's on my wrist now is the Suunto Spartan Ultra, but there's also the Suunto Spartan Trainer, and that's like the version that's $100 or $200 cheaper and actually has a smaller battery life and is actually a little bit slim on the wrist. Garmin have the same thing. They've got their Phoenix, which is huge and chunky, and they've got like the 235 or the 735, which tend to be a little bit smaller. And there's like also the Apple Watch, right? That's tiny. That's very small on your wrist. So it depends what you want out of the watch. Do you want something that's going to get you through a whole week without recharging, or a big 100K ultra, or do you want something that's just going to get you through a 5K on the road? So there are plenty of like cheaper end watches that are actually a little bit smaller on your wrist. Mm. So every brand.
The other thing is, what do you want from your watch? Do you just want to look at your pace and keep track of it and just link it to Strava so you can look what you're doing? You don't need a top-end watch if you don't use the data. And the other thing to consider is, how good do you look whilst you're running?
Mm-hmm.
Like, I look terrible, and people don't look at my wrist because they see my face and they're like, fuck, that guy's struggling. So it doesn't matter. I could wear a dinner plate on my wrist and people wouldn't notice.
Can you do that? I feel like that's something you'd actually do.
I can try.
Put it on Instagram. And the other thing is, like, when you first put a running watch on your wrist, they all feel big, all of them. They all feel chunky because they all have a bigger battery than your normal day-to-day watch. So they all feel terrible when you first put them on. But they're all actually pretty lightweight, and you'll get used to it.
Mm,
so personally, when I first, my current watch, which I've owned for like 5 years now, when I first put that on my wrist, I was like, oh, my God, this thing's heavy. It's bouncing around. It's huge. What the hell? You know, I wore it for a week, and it's just part of me. I don't even think about it. I don't think it looks that big, but anyhow.
I'm the same. When I first put mine on, I was like, nah, this is the worst. And now it's just my watch.
Yeah, exactly. I wear it every day. Tina also asks about, should she wear a headband or a cap? And when it's raining, does she wear a vest or nothing? And my response is, like, do what you want. I sometimes wear a hat, I sometimes don't. I used to wear a headband when I was like a teenager, and I really avoid that now, because I did look like a bit of a twat. And then she says, when it's raining, like, do you wear a vest or do you not? Again, I probably do 50-50. If it's really cold and raining, then yeah, I wear a vest. If it's not that cold and raining, then I don't. Like, it's just water, right? Just do what makes you feel comfortable.
So Tina, being from the UK, so it's probably cold and rainy, you'll probably want to wear a vest to stay warm.
Yes.
The main thing is, when you get wet and then there's a wind, it's the worst.
It's terrible. Yeah.
Getting wet is fine. It's just when there's a wind, it's just cold, and it's just miserable.
Yeah. And so my experience living in Sydney is normally it's cold for the first 2 to 3 Ks, and then you warm up and you take the jacket off and you just have to hold it. So I really tend against running in a jacket when it's cold and wet, because I know in 10 minutes I'll be warm. So yeah, I don't know, trial and error.
Yeah. And then Tina says she feels like she needs a rucksack for all of it. Well, you can just actually buy a running pack and run with a rucksack.
Yeah.
It's a thing.
Yeah, it's been done. But there's actually, and there's something, and I wish I was sponsored to say this shit, but I'm really not. There's a brand called Naked Apparel, like naked stuff. So I've got a naked running belt and it sits around my waist, and man, that carries so much stuff. I can put my phone, like a drink bottle, a jacket, my keys. Like I can put so much stuff in there. It just sits around my waist. It's actually pretty comfy. So like I quite often wear that, and I have from time to time taken off a layer, a jacket, and stuffed it in my naked belt, which sits around my waist. So there are things like that out on the market as well. So yeah, have a look. It's worth investing in some like decent quality stuff, I think. Decent jacket and decent waist belts to put it all in. Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, and like I think that's it, Paddy. That's all the questions that have been asked so far.
Except there's two more questions that we have not answered, and I'm saving them for next week. They're both in relation to feet, running bare feet, and how to get better, stronger feet.
Yeah.
And I looked at those questions. I'm like, I can't just answer them real quick. That's going to be a whole episode. So shout outs to Chris Mount and Candace Chambers, because we're going to talk about you guys next week on our 1 year podcast anniversary.
Yeah, sweet. Which
we always kind of joked we'd do that podcast drunk, and we still might. So
we can make it happen, depending on what time we record and if we still have to work.
And we have to go to work afterwards.
Yeah.
So we'll talk about that stuff next week, which I'm pretty actually super pumped about. It's going to be good because I like talking about feet. I reckon I have an undiagnosed foot fetish, and we'll use that for our 1 year podcast.
You definitely do.
Fuck. Damn it.
there's been a few other questions, but like, we're not going to answer those.
But they're all stupid.
Yeah. Like Chris Michael Jackson, shut up. Stuart Donaldson, mate, just don't. Brie. Nah, Paul Foster, mate, just go away.
And this is good banter. This is part of the running community, right? I like this stuff. Bit of jibber jabber on the posts that we put. It's real good. It's healthy.
Yeah.
Sweet. Thanks for listening, crew. We'll chat next week for our 1 year podcast, which I'm pretty pumped about. And I guess. Mike's back from overseas, and I've got UTMB coming up in 5 or 6 weeks. So shit's happening.
It's going to be good. And as we said at the beginning, hit us up if you have any questions, if you want to get in touch with us for any like online stuff, any online consults, any help with running programs, because we're out here and we're happy to help. And the usual follows on Insta and Facebook and the general interwebs.
And the internet. Cool. Sick. All right. Thanks, crew. Well, we'll chat to you next week.